This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to another episode of Echoes of Dissent, a weekly podcast that explores the events, the movements, the beliefs and the personalities. In short, the why a song of protest, a song of dissent was written and sung, and who created it. We look at its impact at the time and its relevance to today, if any. My name is Frank Carter, and today we will be looking at racism. Racism enforced by legislation of the state and supported by a complicit media. We look at how it can be overturned. We will be focusing on events in South Africa. While most certainly not excusing the policies, I sometimes feel that South Africa has been often hypocritically singled out and merely an example of systemic oppression based on race that we see in many countries throughout the world. We had hoped this was fading away. Sadly, as we will see, such racism is attempting to make a comeback through the resurgence of nationalist parties. Today's track was released in 1988. It is a sing-along we can have a party to.
Happy. Oh, she don't care about the rest at all. She's got a sister.
really some 10 years after Steve Biko died in the back of a police van, 7 years after the 1981 New Zealand Springbok tour that at times violently divided New Zealand, and just 2 years after the 1986 infamous and privately funded all-white Cavalier rugby team toured South Africa in defiance of the RFU. In 2 years, in 1990, Nelson Mandela is to be released after 27 years in prison. This track was initially banned in South Africa, but became a rallying cry across the world. And perhaps at this point I can bring in a personal anecdote or personal memory of the 1981 Springbok tour. I didn't go to any of the matches. I didn't even try. But was in discussion with a very dear family that I knew at that time up north. I was up in just north of Whangarei at the time. And this family, Māori family, could not understand what all the fuss was about. They couldn't understand why there was the protests, or there were the protests against the Springbok tour. Until I explained to them that their daughter would not have been allowed to marry their son-in-law in South Africa, because their daughter's Māori and their son-in-law was Pākehā. I also explained that I probably wouldn't be sitting here discussing these issues with you under apartheid in South Africa. They found that very hard to believe. I'm not quite sure whether they believed it immediately, but that's the only way I could explain it at the time. Apartheid, the official government policy and legal structure, was on its last legs in 1988. President de Klerk was beginning to meet with and become friends with Nelson Mandela. This song asks us to question what we believe about the people we have never met, our neighbours. It doesn't just protest against the legislation, against the media. It asks us to question how we came to believe what we do believe about the people we have never met, about our neighbours, about the people up the street and the families that live in communities we've never visited. It asks us to question why we have these preconceptions. Well, Joanna, she runs a country. She runs in Durban and the Terence Park. She makes a few of her people happy. Oh, she don't care about the rest at all. Here, Eddie Grant personifies South Africa as Joanna. Johannesburg, of course, as a direct address to the heart of the apartheid state. This is where the government was. The opening lines invoke the image of South Africa's white minority government. Joanna, she runs the country. Projected to the world as a prosperous modern nation with a high standard of living. It did indeed have a high standard of living for a definite minority. He immediately subverts this by exposing it as a facade, because he mentions she makes a few of her people happy. Oh, but she doesn't care about the rest at all. He establishes the tension between a nation built on equality, where one group's comfort relies entirely on another's systemic oppression, exploitation, and brutalization. She's got a system they call apartheid. It keeps a brother in a subjection. But maybe pressure will make Joanna see. This verse attacks the legal apparatus of apartheid directly. It focuses on the notorious pass laws as the grotesque inversion of justice. Black South Africans were forced to prove their innocence wherever they went, their right to be in a city rather than being presumed innocent. The pass laws required black South Africans to carry a pass, a reference book at all times, containing their identity, their employment status, and their authorised location, where they were allowed to live and go. Failure to produce it on demand by police led to arrest, imprisonment, and forced relocation to their homeland, where they were told to live. The line, "Maybe pressure will make Joanna see," reflects hope. And this is the line at the beginning throughout the song. It reflects hope that the international and internal pressure could lead to change and unity.
Give me hope, Joanna. Hope, Joanna. Give me hope, Joanna. For the morning come. Give me hope, Joanna. Hope, Joanna. Hope before the morning come.
This, of course, is the plea for hope and change, urging the apartheid regime to recognise the need for equality before it's too late. Before it's too late, before the revolution comes, before the morning comes. Now, he doesn't say revolution. He is saying the morning. The inference, of course, is the morning, the rising of the sun, a bright new dawn for our country. Underlying that, of course, is the other side of revolution, which Eddie Grant is not, absolutely not, supporting or suggesting. He is hoping for a bright new dawn.
I hear she makes all the gold and money to buy new weapons and the shape of guns. While every mother in a black Soweto fears the killing of another son.
Here, the regime's militarized, the violence, particularly in Soweto. Soweto, of course, sounds like an African name, an indigenous African name. It's not. It's an abbreviation of South Western Township. It's not a name, South African name. It's not an indigenous African name. It's a name given to a town where black Africans had to live. It's a hotspot of anti-apartheid resistance, of course. And the focus on the gold and money and the weapons highlights the regime's priority on oppression. If you're oppressing somebody, if you haven't got their will, you buy weapons, you do it by force. Oppression over the well-being. They were forcing, they were using oppression rather than being concerned about the well-being of the population.
Sneaking across all the neighbor's borders. Now and again.
Now, this verse exposes the absolute hypocrisy of the apartheid system. Eddie Grant refers to Sun City, which was located in the supposedly independent homeland of Bophuthatswana, which the South African government had declared as an independent nation. So, of course, as an independent nation, it didn't have to follow the strict apartheid rules. So it allowed mixing of Africans, black Africans, and whites. And especially in the fun times. It's referred to as a camouflage for evil because it allowed the apartheid regime to maintain a facade of progress, while the majority of the population suffered under the oppression. You see, South Africa was able to say, well, look how open we are. Look, we are progressing towards. But in actual fact, it was a demonstration of the absolute hypocrisy because there was no lessening of the oppression on the majority of South Africa. Sun City was available to the rich and the wealthy. The rich and the wealthy tend to be the white population. Eddie Grant here is putting together the wealth and the poverty. The wealth that is allowed to cross the border and doesn't have to worry about apartheid. Sun City was reincorporated into the country after the end of apartheid in 1994. This demonstrated the reality. Apartheid ended in 1994. Sun City was back in South Africa. That was reality. The Bophuthatswana was never recognized internationally as a separate state.
She got supporters in higher places who turn their heads to the city's sun. Joanna, give them the fancy money, oh, to tempt anyone who come. She even knows how to swing opinion in every magazine and the journals.
Here, Grant is exposing the complicity of the international and the local elites who benefit from and ignore apartheid injustices. Yes, South Africa welcomed investment of the big corporates in this wonderful, beautiful country that was very prosperous. And then the reference, Grant references the swing opinion and the good explanation. He critiques the propaganda and the regime's attempts to justify its actions. And he notes underlying this is the complicity of the press. Instead of defying oppressive laws, the newspaper press union, a union you would expect to be supporting workers and the majority, the newspaper press union negotiated agreements with the state and imposed top-down self-censorship on journalists. This is self-censorship, which eroded fundamental press freedoms. Black journalists who tried to report on police brutality and the realities of life under apartheid faced deeply discriminatory environment. As one editorial from the Times stated, stories from black writers were routinely rejected due to an unwritten rule that these black writers could not be trusted with telling the truth. In contrast, police versions justifying the killings of students and other political activists was most of the time accepted without question. At the beginning of the program, we referenced Steve Biko, who died in the back of a police van. The police reported he committed suicide. The media reported he committed suicide. He didn't. He died from neglect and brutality in the back of a policeman. The systemic exclusion of black perspectives allowed the state's false narratives to dominate the public discussion. And this suppression of the alternative media was a key part of the system. You see, if you haven't got an alternative media, how do people know what's happening? The government actively banned and silenced publications that gave a voice to black South Africans. The pivotal day was October the 19th in 1977, when the apartheid government banned The World and The Weekend World, two prominent anti-apartheid newspapers, and arrested their editor, Peter Khoboza. This attack was voices in the wake of Steve Biko's murder. After Steve Biko's murder, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was a commission set up after apartheid was introduced in order to attempt to heal the wounds, held a special hearing on the media in 1997 to investigate these issues and concluded that the mainstream media had failed in its duty to provide the public with the truth. I guess that's easy to say, but if you're being closed down forcibly and arrested and silenced, it's hard to do anything else. The difficulty, of course, for the government then, and even more so now, is the underground newspapers, which cannot be suppressed. And especially now, with the social media, the internet, there are governments, of course, which attempt to suppress and silence the internet. It can't happen. It doesn't happen. There's just too much around. For every bad move that this Joanna make, they got a good explanation. Oh, give me hope, Joanna, give me hope, Joanna, give me hope, Joanna, for the morning come. Give me hope, Joanna, give me hope, Joanna, hope before the morning come. Even the preacher who works for Jesus, a peaceful man, together say that the freedom fighters will overcome the very strong. I wanna know if you're blind, Joanna, if you wanna hear the sound of drum, can't you see that the tide is turning? Oh, don't make me wait till the morning come. Here, of course, he references Desmond Tutu, who was a pivotal South African Anglican bishop and Nobel Peace Prize winner in 1984. He championed non-violence and reconciliation, focused a struggle against apartheid. As a moral leader, he advocated for international sanctions. He urged dialogue over violence and later chaired the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to mend the divided nation. Key aspects of Tutu's anti-apartheid stance were commitment to non-violence. This was the underlying part of his Christian faith, to promote forgiveness and peacefulness, even though often under intense pressure. International activism. He promoted support he required, he asked for, he urged the international community to impose economic and political and cultural sanctions on South Africa, which is where the 1981 protests came in, and the 1986 Cavaliers also feature. He had a rainbow nation vision. He aimed for a democratic, non-racial society, famously calling for the rights of all citizens, black and white, to live together as equals. And he said that he argued that apartheid was not merely political, but it was blasphemous evil that was inherently anti-Christian, arguing that it violated the divine dignity of God's children. Of course, across the Atlantic, in the southern states, we saw the opposite argument used. Some examples from the Old Testament, which supported and justified slavery. Perhaps the subject of a future program. No, definitely the subject of a future program across the Pacific. Sorry, across the Atlantic. But Tutu's ability to unite diverse and often opposing factions during the transition to democracy made him a central figure in liberating South Africa. Now, Eddie Grant. Let's look at Eddie Grant. Where did he grow? Where is he from? The background. Let's have a look at Eddie Grant, the singer, and his development. He was born in 1948. He's from Guyana, a British singer. And he moved to London at the age of 12, and he became interested. He was in the music scene. After watching Chuck Berry, he formed a group called The Equals. Now, I do recall these, The Equals. They had a massive success with Baby Come Back. Now, I had no understanding or recognition of the importance of this group, because apparently it was one of the first multicultural groups in the UK. Baby Come Back is sort of it was a massive song, but it was just, you know, one of the broad, you know, those songs that sing-along type of songs. After 1971, he shifted to production. Then in the 80s, he had a couple of massive I Don't Want to Dance, Electric Avenue, which is likely, again, another one is likely to be subject of a future song, and this one, Give Me Hope, Joanna. The musical style of this track is the reason it's so attractive. The reason it has its reggae foundation. It's built on the classic reggae offbeat, and it has the melody, the melodic bass line, but it's a bit laid back. The drum is laid back. It also has the early digital production. It this is in the late 80s, of course. Early digital production. It does not try to go back to original non-digital stuff. It does embrace the trend towards digital production, and it has that infectious repetitive chorus, and it uses the word hope is one of those things that we all look for, so it's repetitive, and it generates that happiness, cheerfulness within us. At the same time, it delivers the verses in a controversial subject in this hopeful reggae style, which is effective. It's upbeat, it's catchy, it's danceable, it contrasts sharply with its serious subject, apartheid in South Africa. The cheerful music invites listeners in and then delivers this powerful anti-apartheid message without being preachy or aggressive. And as I said, the word, it has this universal hope, hope. Give Me Hope, Joanna became a massive hit in Europe. And in 1994, it was the anti-apartheid anthem, solidifying its legacy as a powerful product. It was banned in South Africa initially, you know, when it was first released. It was banned in South Africa, but it became universal. So, of course, it was banned in South Africa. If it's massive in Europe, it's going to be heard in South Africa anyway. Its relevance and legacy today. While the specific system it protested has fallen, the song remains relevant because it's adaptable to its broader message of social justice. Grant has noted that while the original content has changed, the song remains relevant to contemporary issues. He sees tensions involving Zimbabwe immigrants in South Africa. We also see the growth of nationalist political movements preaching prejudice, racial prejudice, in USA and in some European countries. The general message, it has a general message of resilience. Today, it is frequently quoted as a reminder that systemic horrors can be overcome. It serves a rhythm of hope for current global conflicts and social struggles. It is a critique of power and perceived dictatorial corporate and political power, not just in South Africa, but in anywhere. In exposing state policy, compliant or biased media, and a supportive education system, it asks us to look at our prejudices and assumptions about our neighbours. It asks us to question and examine the sources of our beliefs and prejudices. Thank you very much for being with us today. Next week, David Rovics will tell us about the high toll paid by journalists in Gaza.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.